Our program this week is brought to you by Music Row Search. Music Row Search is a music industry recruiting firm that focuses solely on executive level placements. Visit them on the web at musicrowsearch.com. Welcome to episode number 2 of the Music Industry Forum podcast. This week, Tom speaks to Brad Turcotte of Music World Entertainment. In 2001, Brad moved to Houston to attend law school, where he later started Compadre Records. He currently serves as the president of Compadre Records, as well as the executive VP of Matthew Knowles' company, Music World. Brad also teaches music business at the Kincaid School and has a music business degree from Belmont University here in Nashville, as well as a law degree. Enjoy the program.
Brad Turcotte, good morning.
Good morning.
Glad to have you here. Hey, tell us a little bit about your music career and kind of what has led you to your current role at Music World Entertainment.
I knew that I wanted to follow a passion, and a passion was music. So my first year at Baylor, I knew that it just wasn't clicking for me. I was undecided. I was trying to find something to follow and pursue, and everything led to music. And I used to go to concerts, whether with friends or by myself, during my freshman year at Baylor. And there was one concert in particular. It was a Leroy Parnell concert. And I don't know if you're familiar with Leroy Parnell, but he, at that time, was signed to Arista Nashville. And he's this amazing guitar player, you know, who also sings. And there was just something about that performance that captivated me. And I felt like, and I'm not trying to be this person that has found a UFO and I'm discussing my experience, but it was as if this light hit me from the stage and told me what to do. And I didn't know what I wanted to do in the music business, but it was something that I knew I had to be a part of that experience. And I didn't know what part of that experience I wanted to be a part of it. It was that passion that Leroy had on stage, that intimacy. And the next day, I called some friends in Nashville who, and you know, I can't really say it was friends in Nashville. I had no friends in Nashville, but I had a friend from home who was studying music at a school in Nashville, and called him, learned a little bit more about the program, and he was a student at Belmont University, a music student. So I had no idea that there was a music business program at Belmont. So I just kind of put that aside. And he said, and I'm not even quite sure he knew about it, but he said that there was a music business program at a neighboring school called MTSU in Middle Tennessee State. So I applied. I got accepted. I had not visited Murfreesboro, Tennessee. And my mom and I went up there to actually move into the dorm, and I felt sick. I felt sick in my stomach for the decision that I'd made. I knew Murfreesboro was not for me. So we sort of just scrapped it, and we went to Nashville as, you know, sort of a sightseeing trip. And I saw Belmont. It's located at the end of Music Row. So I thought, well, why don't I just go in and talk to the admissions people? And this was a month before school was going to start. So, you know, told me about the music business program that they had, and I applied that day, got accepted the next week, rushed up the following week to move in. They had no more dorms. They put me in a hotel. Throughout that 3 years at Belmont, meeting the best friends that I have today, they're all within the music industry. I talked to them, if not on a daily basis, on a weekly basis. We worked together. They have executive positions throughout the industry, and it was a huge turning point for me. So throughout that time, I made it a point to intern at different segments of the industry so I could get a full view of everything that Nashville had to offer. So it was either a booking agency, I wrote record reviews for a little bit, I was a song plugger, and my last internship was at a law firm. And I worked with three different entertainment attorneys, and I thought, well, I think this is for me. That's the area that I want to pursue. No matter what you have to do in the music industry, you have a contract attached to it. Whether or not you're a songwriter, you're an artist, you're a concert venue, you're buying advertising in a magazine, there is a signature to be had on everything. So I thought, well, you know what, this is probably the best sort of future that I could have. So, you know, I started pursuing that a little bit. But along the way, I met a girl who went to Vanderbilt and became my girlfriend, who now is my wife. And she told me that when she graduated, she was moving to Texas. And if I wanted to continue the relationship, I had to follow. And you know what? I loved her. I still love her. So I moved to Texas, and I have not moved back. Hopefully we will one day. But I can't say that I cried when I moved back, but I was pretty upset because I went to Nashville for a very specific reason, and I moved to Texas for a different reason. So I had to make the best of my surroundings. The first thing that I did was, it could have been the first weekend or the second weekend. We moved to Dallas, and we made a trip out to Billy Bob's nightclub, which is, you know, a very historic, well-storied dance club in Texas. And as a song plugger, I had been working with the club GM. He was trying to get songs for his house band. So I'd never met him face-to-face. And while I was backstage, I met a young regional artist named Corey Morrow. And at the time, Corey had just released his second record. And he was selling 15 to 20,000 copies of his record. Now, this was 2000, and I was 19. He was selling 20,000 copies of his record just in local record stores, Hastings. He really just had a regional distributor. And through that conversation, I realized that he was sending records to radio stations on personal letterhead. He wasn't addressing the envelope to a specific program director. He wasn't following up. He didn't have a press kit. And, you know, these were all things that I had learned in school that I felt like, well, I could apply. You know, I found myself asking questions as if I was taking a test back in school. And, you know, he wasn't able to check off any of these things that I had known. So we sort of built this relationship, and I started managing him. And Compadre, I told him that, you know, he needs to create a label in order to send. It looks a little more professional and legitimate when you send something to a radio station being represented by a label. So we created Compadre Records, and Corey paid for the logo, and everything was then sent moving forward on Compadre Records stationery. When I called to follow up, I was calling on behalf of Compadre Records, but it was really just a logo. And I have to admit that today, I still use that same logo that Corey paid for. You know, 1 year later, I decided to go and pursue law. So I separated from Corey, and I asked him if I could take the logo and the label. And he said, yeah, absolutely. I didn't take any Corey Morrow product. It wasn't associated that way. And even if you look at Corey's product today, there, Compadre was never a part of the record. It was just, I don't know, it's sort of hard to explain, really. It was just this moment in time where press releases were sent out. So, you know, it was an easy separation, and, you know, we're still good friends today. But took it with me, took the logo with me. That was really the only thing to take, and attended law school here in Houston. And my second year of law school, just from that whole experience with Corey, I discovered this underground Texas country scene. And it was definitely not as big as it is today. There were just a handful of players: Pat Green, Corey Morrow, Kevin Fowler, Roger Krager, and, of course, Jerry Jeff Walker and Jack Ingram, Robert O'Keefe. That was really it. There was just about six. But then there were all these smaller musicians that were opening for these guys. And I felt like there was a need. At this time, there were no compilations out in this area that had all of them together. So I put together two compilations at basically no cost. I didn't pay any advances. I found a local art student to handle the artwork for me. I used the same local distributor that I worked with Corey. And we put it out. Well, I put it out. My wife and I stuffed envelopes, and the first record, which actually came out 3 days before 9/11, a brief history, which I don't think has been too brief, but so this was my, well, That was my second year of law school, and then a year later, I ended up signing Hayes Carl. Hayes was a local musician. I got a tip from the Houston Press music editor saying, "You know, you got to go out and look at this kid. He's fantastic live." I signed him because I had some money and distribution from the compilations, and he had created a record. He didn't know anything about marketing distribution. He didn't have a booking agent, so I did know that in order to at least release this record, I needed a tour schedule for him. So I personally booked his tour from Houston all the way to New York City and back. And then we released the record. And I'm proud to say that he signed to Universal last year after three records. And a year later, I graduated from law school having signed Susie Boggess and Billy Joe Shaver. And, you know, the rest is history. We've released 33 records before selling to Matthew Knowles.
Fantastic. You know, the inspiring thing about that story is how humble it began. You know, you and your wife sitting there stuffing envelopes. You know, that, Brad, that resonates so well with so many people who aspire to make it in the music industry.
Thank you for that. But I feel like, you know, even today I'm stuffing envelopes. I'm taking out the trash. I don't have someone answering my phones. I handle my files myself. I didn't even know what a product manager was until I got to Music World. I just know that I'm going to try to do everything that I possibly can, because if I don't, then I'm not fully informed. And if I'm not fully informed, then I can't realistically speak to my artists, my vendors, with any sort of firm knowledge. You know, music is a business built on passion, and that passion stems from the artist. We are businessmen, but we're trying to guide people's dreams. We're not guiding someone's widget business. Now, this is a business built on dreams, and when you're not completely focused on that artist, it's a life changer. I'm not saying that we're doctors, that we're saving lives, but we're guiding someone's dream. And if I don't share that same passion that the artist does, we're never going to get anywhere.
Hey, you've mentioned Matthew and Music World. Tell us about your current role at Music World Entertainment, and how did you wind up getting into business with those guys?
Well, it's been very exciting since coming over here. When I started Compadre, I had no major label experience. I had never really worked at an independent label other than just interning for a couple months. So from 2001 to 2007, when I had sold to Matthew, I had never had a mentor. I worked in a small little office in downtown Houston, and everything I did was based on gut and math. And if the math didn't work, you know, gut comes first, and then you've got to apply math. And that was it. Well, of course, there's passion, but gut and math, that was it. But at this point in my life, I absolutely needed a mentor. And I felt like when I met Matthew, we spoke together on a panel in October of 2006 in Austin. And there was this immediate rapport among each other. And he wanted to get into the country music business. And I didn't necessarily release only country music, but I did know Nashville very well. So when he gave me an offer, it was the most interesting offer that I had received to date, because I knew that Matthew didn't know anything about Nashville, but he knew deal making, he knew Top 40, he knew pop culture, and he absolutely knew how to make a star. And those are things that I wanted to learn about. I wanted to be in a room with him when he made a deal. And I have to admit that over the past year and a half, he has included me as much as possible. I've been in boardrooms at Walmart, Microsoft. I've had lunch on the French Riviera with a CEO of a top five ad agency. And he has been that mentor that I had hoped that he would have been. And, you know, he continues to keep me as involved as possible. And
tell me, has it changed your focus musically? In other words, do you still live in that Texas country world, or are you also living in the Beyonce world?
focus of Compadre, I would say it has changed. I'd say the flip side of the coin for coming over to Matthew was experimenting in mainstream music. I felt like that I had, let's use a baseball analogy. I felt like that I had been at AAA baseball long enough, and it was time to taste a little bit of the majors. So my first project when I came here was a mainstream country project, Trent Wilman. I was finally able to risk a little bit and experiment at mainstream radio. The Johnny Cash remix project was a bigger budget than I could have done at Compadre. And just, you know, a little bit about the Johnny Cash remix project. You know, we have Snoop Dogg on the record. Would not have probably gotten a phone call with Snoop Dogg's camp at the old Compadre. So, you know, they're just bits and pieces of what Matthew's been able to bring professionally that I've been able to apply here. Matthew did all that he could, although he doesn't know country very well. We got on a plane together, and we flew to Dallas, and we met with country program directors together. He went to Nashville. We met with CMT. He loves learning about country music and talking to professionals, and he's really giving a big effort. A lot of people should commend him for it, mm-hmm. because I doubt they know it.
Tell us a little bit more about the Johnny Cash compilation, because I think a lot of folks have probably been surprised that that would come out from Music World Entertainment and Compadre.
It's a project. Okay, before I sold Compadre to Music World, I put together this exploratory committee to purchase Sun Records. And Sun Records, if you don't know, is the original home of Elvis, Johnny Cash. It was owned by Sam Phillips, who pretty much just created the rock and roll genre, signing Carl Perkins, Roy Orbison, Jerry Lee Lewis. It was an amazing catalog. And through that process, I tried to create ways that we could rejuvenate that catalog, and I thought about the remix series. And I'm a huge fan of what Verve and Motown did with their catalog through the remix series, and you know, one of my favorite records of all time is the Nina Simone remix, and it's tastefully done. So when I came over to Music World, this was just a project that I didn't think about really at the old Compadre. It's something I probably would have done. I wouldn't have done it to this level that we were able to execute here at Music World. But you know, it's funny. I did a track on spec. And I presented it to the owners of Sun Records. They listened to it, and they said no. They said, there's no way we're going to let you do this to Johnny Cash's catalog. You're going to alienate fans. I said, well, you know, I have to be honest with you. I'm a fan of Johnny Cash, and I absolutely love this. But I'm not interested in Johnny Cash's core group. I hope that a majority of them will like this record. But I'm interested in the Rick Rubin produced Johnny Cash audience. It's the audience that went out and purchased 2 to 3 million copies of his record. That's the alternative young crowd that I made this record for. I made it for the pop culture crowd. And he said, well, still, we're not going to let you do it. But if you get John Carter Cash's approval, we'll let you do this. Well, fortunately, I was actually in Nashville working with John Carter Cash, which is John and June Carter Cash's only child. I was working with him on the Billy Joe Shaver record. So I, on the same day, took the track out to John Carter, and he listened to it, big smile on his face, and he loved it. He got it right away. He said, this is exactly what my dad would have done if he was alive today. He was always pushing the boundaries, always looking for new things to do with his music, which is the reason he signed with Rick Rubin. And he said, this is something I know my dad was seriously considered. How can I help? I said, well, please talk with Sun. So he, you know, sent an email to them. I'm one of the executive producers. I'm giving approval. So, you know, the rest is history, and we're really excited about it. It comes out January 27th, but I'll just sort of segue that into the future of Compadre. I love these projects. I love these artistless projects, projects that are more of an event than a tour schedule, meaning that There may be other remixes in the future, and there's one that I'm about to dot that final I on for 2009, which I believe will be bigger than the Cash remix.
Brad, let's talk a little bit about Beyonce, because let's face it, there's not very many bigger names in the industry than Beyonce and all the exciting things that she's been doing, talking about pushing boundaries and creating new audiences. What's it like to work with her?
She is absolutely amazing. She, and I'm not saying that because, you know, for obvious reasons, but I have never, just internally, I've never heard a negative thing about her. She's an extremely hard worker. You know, for this current record, she has 18 songs on it. There's an R&B and then there's a pop side, but she recorded almost 70 songs before she came up with the collection that's on her album. She practices and rehearses for her tour schedule like nothing I've seen before, and she is who you see on TV. There's never controversy. She's always pleasant, always warm, talking to everyone here at Music World. It's just been fantastic. So I like to see when she steps out on roles like Dreamgirls and Cadillac Records, because she has that. She takes that natural personality, and it seems to translate pretty well to big screen. We're releasing, you know, the Cadillac Records soundtrack is a co-venture with Music World. And then she has another movie, which she is an executive producer of, coming out in February called Obsessed. And Music World has a co-venture with Geffen for that project. We are servicing a cover of Etta James' At Last to Urban AC stations later this month. So Beyonce will have three songs at radio going into Christmas.
Brad, what's on your iPod right now? What have you been listening to outside of work?
You know what? I love my iPod. Absolutely love it. I think I'm on my fourth or fifth generation. I'm a huge Mac user. And I have to say that I probably have about 4,000 records. So I have everything from, well, Beyonce remixes to, you know, every album George Strait and Merle Haggard have released, to John Coltrane and Nina Simone, and everything in between, from U2 to early Elvis. I mean, I'm just a huge music fan. The good thing about music and why I love it so much is the variety.
You mentioned earlier how life-changing that Leroy Parnell show was. What was the very first concert you ever attended?
The first concert I attended, I think, was Dwight Yoakam in Austin, Texas, and Susie Boggess opened, and Rick Trevino opened. And it's funny that I've had an opportunity now to work with Susie Boggess from signing her, and then for a short time I managed Rick Trevino. So, you know, it was nice to share to both of them that they were a part of the first concert that I'd ever attended.
Brad, you've had sounds like an amazing career in such a short period of time, and your story, I must admit, is very inspiring to a lot of the folks that are trying to figure out this crazy thing we call the music industry. And I appreciate you sharing all your stories and your thoughts. And
my pleasure.
Just really want to thank you for taking the time to talk to us at the Music Industry Forum.
No problem. If I can leave on something, I always like to say this, and it's something that I had heard long ago, and it's just a simple phrase that someone will eventually get it. It may not be, you know, whether or not you're a songwriter or you're a professional outside of the music business with an idea, or it's just your general personality at work or your work ethic, someone will eventually get it. And I just feel like a lot of people give up after their first no or negative experience, or even their third or fourth negative experience, but it always will work. I took a huge risk by opening a label at a very young age and pursuing it. And, you know, eventually I assure you, I was getting discouraged after my fourth or fifth year doing Compadre and not really having that huge breakout moment. But, you know, Matthew got it. Eventually, someone got it. And, you know, now I feel like this is that next step in my career. And I just seem to carry that. But I think it's a universal opinion. Whether or not you wanted something to end on, I just always like to share that if I'm speaking somewhere.
That's a perfect ending, and I appreciate it very much.
All right. Well, thank you, Tom, and everyone listening on the forum.
We hope you enjoyed this week's program. You can always reach us through our blog at blog.musicindustryforum.com. We'd love to hear your feedback and show ideas. And look for the show next week. We're going to be featuring BJ Lederman. Thanks, everyone. See you soon.